Brian Kane Fitness, online fitness coach, nutritionist, business coach, public speaker, and best-selling author. Brian, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to the Lifestyle Lifter Show.
Pleasure's all mine, Adrian. Thank you so much for having me on.
Brian, before you give us a quick recap on your backstory, Brian, share something about yourself. Man, you have 300 to 400 podcast episodes at this stage, so share something about yourself that most people do not know.
I use my escapism and my downtime is 95% consumed with watching retro video games, old WWF clips, and at the minute I'm big on a channel on that's going through like the old Pokemon Game Boy speedruns with different Pokemon. God. So I'm spending my evenings as my escape time at the minute just consuming that kind of rubbish on YouTube.
Yeah, who am I to judge, man? Absolutely. Okay. I know you're big into the consoles and stuff. I saw that on your TikToks. Brian, I know a lot of people obviously listening to this would be familiar with yourself and your backstory, but maybe in just like 2 or 3 minutes, Brian, would you mind like sharing your backstory to what got you into this game in the first place and how you've become who you have become in the process?
Yeah, so it's kind of I'll keep it short as an elevator pitch because it's quite similar to your story, Adrian, which I know your audience are familiar with. I used to be a primary school teacher, so I think we overlapped kind of a little bit in terms of when we were both teaching. I, in 2011, was working full-time as a primary school teacher and really didn't enjoy that work and enjoy that job. I spent 4 years in college to get an undergraduate degree in business. I then went and did a postgraduate in London to become a primary school teacher. I walked into my first teaching job just as a male
guy
shortage in terms of male teachers, and I had a sporty background and I was willing to take on PE coordinator in the school. So I basically walked into a job. And I'd say 30 minutes into my first ever day of teaching, Adrian, I thought, oh my God, what am I doing? I don't want to work this job. I don't want to be a teacher. And there was this kind of realization moment. And a very long story short, the analogy I've used in books, which you know from podcasts as well, is I felt I'd spent years climbing a ladder. And when I got to my first teaching job, I realized it was up against the wrong wall. And it took me another 2.5 years, nearly 3 years in total, to go back and get it back to the bottom of the ladder against the right wall, which for me was the fitness industry. So for 2.5 years, I worked as a teacher during the day and a personal trainer at nighttime. And we can delve into whatever direction you want with that. And then in 2014, I moved back home, moved back in with my mom and dad. My sister gave me her old crappy little Toyota Yaris, like one of those cars that was as old as I was. Like you close the door and the whole thing, like all the windows fall down, and one of those cars. And it did the job on 80% of the occasions. It got me to where I needed to be. And in 2014, I read a book by Gary Vaynerchuk, which was called Crush It. And I had never heard of Gary V. I'd never heard of Gary Vaynerchuk, but this book came across, I think it was my Audible, or it came across through an audio app. I was listening to books and he was speaking about social media as a business differentiator. And I thought, you know what? I'm not doing any of this. I was like, I have a personal training business. I'm making this go full time. I'm giving myself 6 months to try and make a personal training business work full time, or else I'll go back teaching. And I said, all right, this social media thing might be a way to play this out. So I set up a Facebook page. I set up an Instagram page. And over the course of the last few years, from, you know, it's 2022 now, so you're talking 8 years, I've been able to build up, you know, hundreds of thousands on my social media platforms. My podcast is one of the top health podcasts in the world. I've written four books, but written three best-selling books. And now I spend my time working with people on programs, doing a lot of speaking, either my own events or a corporate. I do podcasts where I get to chat to really cool people. And yeah, I'm just one of those very fortunate people that gets to live a life and do things that I would do for free, and I get paid very well for it. So I'm very grateful for the things that I have, the people I have in my life, the opportunities that I get. But yeah, that's a kind of an elevator pitch on from there to now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I would have taken such inspiration from you, because I think I came across your content first, Brian, around about 2016. And then I did my PT course in 2017, and obviously being a teacher too at the time, like, honestly, I know you got to number 7 in the worlds in Las Vegas when you stepped up on stage, but no word of a lie, Brian. Mammy's looking at photos there. I was like, there's no way a guy from Galway can possibly look so freaking jacked? Like, I just thought that was for the Hollywood and for the movies, man. But like, I genuinely didn't think it was even possible. So I think that even just like you and your journey, I know, I'm sure a lot of people say this, but you've really like inspired so many other people to understand what's actually possible when you, you know, you set your mind to something. As Napoleon Hill said, what the mind can conceive and believe it can achieve. And I just, I took such inspiration from that, Brian. So tell me then, because I obviously had a lot of self-limiting beliefs over like, you know, it's not possible for someone in Galway who's from, you know, Mam Cross in Connemara to do so well. Tell me, Brian, how did you like go from leaving the quitting the teaching in 2014 to actually, you know, getting to number 7 in the world when you stepped up on stage?
So firstly, I really appreciate that, Adrian, the kind words. I'll take a minute to acknowledge and accept those, because I really appreciate that. And it's funny that you talk about self-limiting beliefs, because right before you went on air, you said that, you know, you and Pat Dively were big inspirations for you on your journey. And Pat was actually the person who made me question all of that, because I was living in London working as a teacher and I saw this guy building up a business in Galway. And I was like, this fella is crushing it. And I thought, I didn't think someone from Galway could do that with business. And it's funny because I went in a different area first. I went competing and did really well in that world. So as you mentioned there, you know, in the top 10 in the world in Vegas, I won my pro card several months before that. So that just basically means you can compete in those shows for money. And I channeled it in that direction because I thought, well, I grew up in the west of Ireland. I live very close to where I grew up, 200 people in my village. And it just wasn't something that people did. And I had those beliefs. And I remember seeing how Pat was doing in business, Pat Dively. And I thought, well, if he can do it in that area, I can do it in this area. So I took inspiration from what he was doing. And weirdly, when I started to compete, and I've covered this on my podcast as well, my experiences with that, my reason for competing was very different to the majority. I used it as a platform to try and build my online presence and try and separate myself as a personal trainer. And it did work. It 100% worked. So I didn't have anything at the time except for I was an in-shape PT, in-shape personal trainer. And most personal trainers are in shape. So that's not a differentiator in and of itself. So I started to compete in these shows, in fitness model shows, physique shows, bodybuilding shows. And I started to do very well in those. Now I'm built for those shows. I've got very good genetics when it comes to muscle mass, muscle maturity. You know, I do ultramarathons now. So even if I'm training for a 100-mile ultramarathon, I don't lose any of my muscle. Like I just have those farmer genes. I grew up on a farm, looking shit around a farm. Like I have those genetics. So I'm built for that bodybuilding world. So I did very well in those shows from the get-go. I finished 4th in my first show and did progressively better as things went on. And the Vegas show in 2015, weirdly, was my last show because my daughter was born about 6 months before that. And when I was competing, I'm a bit better now in my mid-30s than I was in my late 20s for that all or nothing mindset. I couldn't compartmentalize things. If I was in something and doing something, I was all in on it. So when I was competing, I was training several hours a day. I was meticulously counting calories and macronutrients. And I was doing everything that was a controllable that would potentially help me place and do better in a show. And when my daughter was born, I felt brain dead. Like you're walking around like a zombie. When you're walking around like what's called dick skin in fucking bodybuilding, where you're like, you feel the back of your wrist, like that's your abs in terms of body fat level. And you might look really lean. I won't say it looks attractive, but you look lean to do well in shows, but you're brain dead. And you just can't string a sentence together. And when Holly was born in the 25th of May, 2015, I was prepping for the world in August that year in Vegas. And I said, this is it. This is going to be my last show. I can't balance these two things. And I did what I call in my second book, Rewire Your Mindset, my 97-year-old rule. That's something I've been using since 2015, 2014. I asked, well, what would my 97-year-old self regret more on my deathbed? That, you know, I didn't give it all and keep competing and pushing that, and I'd have a crap relationship with my daughter, or I'd have a great relationship with my daughter and I had to let go of who I thought I needed to be as a competitor. So that made the decision quite easy when I was able to do that kind of thought experiment into the future. And it just allowed me to focus and prioritize on other things. But that self-limiting belief is something that doesn't necessarily have to be in the world of competition. It's kind of domain dependence. We all have it in some versions, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, I can't get a boyfriend or girlfriend or a partner because, you know, I have self-worth issues, or I can't lose weight, or I can't get in shape because, you know, I don't know how, or you know, what would happen, like what I call people spending their millions before they've earned it. Well, what happens if I lose all the weight and then I can't keep it off? I'm like, well, focus on the process and how you do it, losing it first, and then you talk about sustaining it after that. And all these self-limiting beliefs that, in my words, came in two folds. It was competing. I grew up idolizing Arnold Schwarzenegger. I was a huge Schwarzenegger fan. You know, Adrian, like, it's something that most fitness people love, and somebody most fitness people love. So competing was something that I always wanted to do, but never believed I could. And running a marathon, weirdly enough, something that I'm into now when it comes to endurance sports, was the other thing that I always wanted to do, but never believed I could. And my language around that was, that's something other people do. And I never thought that, well, actually, that's something I could do. Was the language was, and I didn't realize that was just your own version of a self-created limitation. My language was, that's something other people do. And once I competed the first ever show, and I stepped on stage, and I was shitting a brick before my first show, terrified, like backstage sweats. I was like, oh my God, what if people laugh at me? Like, what are they going to say? What if I go out there and I finish last? And all these thoughts going through my head. And although I did really well in my first show, it wasn't the placing that gave me the confidence. It was the ability to push past the fear and the state that I felt, because in that moment, I was so afraid it would have been easy to not step on stage and not actually go past the curtain. And as a result of that, I got a lot of confidence. And then confidence is what I call in my second book, Rewire Your Mindset, like legs on a table, that every time you set a goal and you hit that goal, you put a little bit of a leg on that table. And every time you set a big goal that you're afraid of and you go and overcome it and go past it, you put a big leg on that table. And then confidence is built over time by consistently keeping promises to yourself. And that's effectively how I got there with the 2015, doing well in those shows, the transition out. But yeah, weirdly, it brings it all back to what you said. There's Pat that gave me that initial.
Unbelievable.
It was permission. That's all it was. And I think a lot of it is, Adrian, you know yourself, it's giving yourself permission to do these things. And it gave me permission to go after a thing that I wanted in a different area. And it made me and used him, Pat, as inspiration to do that. I put this on my stories last week and on a solo podcast that I don't think you should idolize people. I don't think that's useful, but I think you can take inspiration for them. Sure. And that's really useful. And Pat was somebody that gave me huge inspiration in the beginning. So I'm eternally grateful. Me and Pat are friends now, but I'm eternally grateful that that was something that I was able to do, I was able to take and, you know, pay it forward when it comes to applying it and having that impact on other people's lives, hopefully indirectly from what you've said anyway.
Unbelievable. And the ironic thing is, actually, so I have a connection here in Galway, and a buddy, so best friend of mine at home, his brother is best friends with Pat Tivity. So ironically, Pat was kind enough to, we had a one-to-one call there just at the start of lockdown, March 2020. And again, like that, I just told him, you know, that himself and yourself were like two big inspirations from me. So I think there's a lot of power in just paying it forward, Brian, and you've definitely done that for many others I know as well. And that's just such a remarkable story, again, about your backstory, the self-limiting beliefs and the confidence. And Brian, let's just kind of fast forward then, because you obviously, you mentioned very, very honestly there that you competed because you wanted to differentiate yourself from the crowd. Because, you know, what makes me different? What makes me unique? So you said, you know what, I'm going to take this up a notch and really like take my physique and take myself to that next level. And as a result of this, you know, I just mentioned the start there, you're an online fitness coach, you're a nutritionist, you're a biz coach, you're a best-selling author, you're a public speaker. How did like the confidence, would say, of like doing something that you initially didn't think you were capable of doing and then seeing yourself come out the other side of that? How do you feel that like positively impacted you when it came to actually scaling your own business? Because you have so many different buckets there for you, Brian. And you mentioned, you know, I am, maybe you may have mentioned fortune or lucky, but like luck is a peculiar habit of favoring those who don't rely on it. And you created your own luck. So can you just talk about that, Brian, of how you've like, you've managed to scale and done so by just investing in yourself and self-education?
Yeah, it's a great question, Adrian, and probably a multifaceted answer is needed. Like when it comes to luck, similar to what you said there, I've been a long-term subscriber that luck is opportunity meeting the prepared mind. And to say that there's not an element of luck would be a complete lie. And I think anybody that does any form of subjective success, because, you know, you can set yourself up for good things to happen, but you also have to be able to take advantage of them when they present themselves. So there was definitely an element of luck. But when it came to controlling the controllables and doing the things that I could do, I followed and to this day still apply the exact same principle. So to pull it right back into 2011, when I was teaching, I was about 4 months into my first teaching job, and I came home that Christmas and I was talking to my mom, who has been literally, in terms of a guiding light and a voice of reason, has been my go-to for as long as I can remember. And she put a question to me that Christmas when I was having a nice little pity party for myself and how much I hated my job, you know, pure victim mode. And she was like, well, what would you do for free? And I'd never thought about that question. And I was like, well, I'd work in a gym for free. I was like, I love training, gym, everything related to fitness. And I had what I call fear disguised as practicality, Adrian, when it came to fitness as a career, where I said that, well, fitness is my outlet. It's my passion. It's the thing I love. If I do this as a career, it might make me fall out of love with it, which is so fucking ridiculous when I think about it now. It's like saying, well, I've met the absolute love of my life. She's incredible, but we'd be better if we broke up. Like it's the same thing. And I got over that fear when she asked, well, what would you do for free? I was like, I'd love to work in fitness. And that was back in 2011. And we're in 2022 now. And I still ask that question when it comes to where I take my business. And I've been indirectly able to scale as a result of only saying yes to things that I would do for free. And because of that, and this is such a hindsight bias because not everybody can do this. So I don't want to offer advice that's actually completely impractical based on situation for people. But I still follow that North Star even in the beginning. And personal training, even when I was working as a teacher and working as a personal trainer at nighttime, every time someone paid me for personal training, I was like, I cannot believe I'm getting paid for this. I was like, this is crazy. Or like, you had to pay me to go in and teach. Like if I was going in to teach the tutors or compound fractions, I'm like, you're fucking paying me for this shit. I was like, I ain't doing this for free. And that was the difference. And I think everybody has a version of something that they would love to do for free. And I still follow that. You know, once it's a case of, would I do this for free? Would I work with this person for free? Would I do this thing for free? Mixed with, does it excite me? And then finally asking, well, will this thing nourish me or will this thing deplete me? That's the kind of filter that I run things through. And once it's hitting the brackets and ticking all the boxes, it's very easy to stay uplifted and excited about your work and fulfilled in what you're doing when you would do it all for free. And also, I've got better with this, Adrian, over the last few years. I tend to, it's called an ultra running and ultra endurance events where you don't get too high on the highs and too lows on the low. So if you're doing a race or a run, when you're low, you realize it's not going to be forever and it'll feel better at some point. And the same as when you're feeling high on 26.2 miles of a marathon, there'll be a point when you're not going to feel so good. And I'm like that now with everything that I do. I don't get too high on the things that seem to be impacting people in a positive way, but I equally don't get low when somebody's being negative or aiming anything negative in my direction. Also, you just understand a lot of psychological projection of people that hurt people. So the more aware you become of these things, the less impact it has. And it's very easy when it comes to business for me to scale and do the things I'm doing because I would do them all for free. Everything I'm doing right now, when it comes to my speaking, the books that I write, the podcasts that I do, the conversations I have, the mastermind groups that I run, the everything programs, the people I work with in courses and programs, they're all things that if I won the lotto and I won €1 billion tomorrow, I would do all of them still. I wouldn't pull any of them. And that's my question, and that's my filter that I pull things back on consistently, because there's times and I'm like, you know what, if I won the lotto or I won €1 billion tomorrow, I wouldn't do X, Y, or Z. And that gives me direct feedback now that that's probably something I need to outsource or remove completely or take away from my business. And as a result, you end up scaling and growing nearly indirectly. And it's so weird because if you would ask me, Adrian, 10 years ago, probably not even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I would have been so focused on growth and getting bigger and expanding and X, Y, and Z. Whereas now you end up doing all of those things, but I don't have any kind of attachment to them. They're like, well, it's just part of the process now. It's part of what I do. It's, and similar to you, Adrian, I think, because we're similar in the sense that we walk around quite lean. We're in shape. We're into fitness. It's our thing. We like training. We like eating a certain way. So it's nearly the part of the process. And the indirect response is this way that you look. And for me, with business, it's similar. If you can get it to the point where you love the process so much and you love the journey so much, the destination nearly becomes irrelevant. And I think, and as I said, I don't want to offer advice that's completely impractical to people based on the starting point, but that North Star, what would you do for free? And what do you love to do is a good question to start with, and then kind of follow that path and see whatever road it goes down.
Awesome. Wow. A lot to unpack there, Brian. A lot to unpack there. That's a phenomenal question. What would you do for free? And I love the 97-year-old rule that you mentioned as well. And even just like, I know Robin Sharma in his book, because you interviewed him in his most recent one, he speaks about like the most common kind of regrets that we have in our deathbed. And a lot of it is like, just, I wish I didn't work as hard and give myself permission to have a bit more fun, to connect with people, to spend more time working on myself and spending them with good quality other people rather than just focusing on growth. And Brian, do you know what? I think this is a nice way to pivot, because there is this kind of, as you know yourself, the conditional happiness, where people say, and I've made this mistake before, and it's something I still feel challenged with to this day, I'll be happy when. So it might be initially, I'll be happy when I get a six pack. I'll be happy when I fit into that dress. I'll be happy when I get the job. I'll be happy when I'm in the relationship. And then when you get there, when you arrive at that destination, you can sometimes just feel really empty. Because if you're just always focusing on, you know, getting there. So can you just talk about, Brian, how can you be blissfully just satisfied here, even if you want to get there? Because when you get there, that becomes a new here. And there's another there. There's another star you want to reach.
Yeah, the bar moves. Like, that's the problem with the I'll be happy when fallacy that I call in books, that when you hit your target, in most cases, the bar tends to move. So you'll get this temporary dopamine rush of, yes, I hit it, amazing. And then it's on to the next thing. And I've struggled with that definitely, because it took me a lot of, I won't say setbacks, probably obstacles that I thought were obstacles that actually became the path and became the way. That I only can see now on reflection. So I'll share it in the hopes that it lands and connects. When it comes to the I'll be happy when fallacy, I've done it in so many different shapes and forms. All the ones you've mentioned. I'll be happy when I'm X amount of body fat. I'll be happy when I'm X amount of muscle. I'll be happy when I've won or done X, Y, or Z in a show. I'll be happy when I have X amount in my bank account. I'll be happy when I have this partner in my life, X, Y, or Z. And there's only so many times you can metaphorically or figuratively be punched in the face before you realize, oh, fuck, this isn't working. And that's what happened, where I got this realization that my whole process is fucked here. And to keep in that ladder, the analogy of a ladder, you know, there's a Buddha quote that says, if you can't be happy on the journey, how would you expect to be happy at the destination? And I needed a more, for me, in terms of a way to navigate my own life, I needed something more practical. Even though I loved the idea of that, I needed something very practical as a visual. And that's where I talk about the ladder up against the right wall and the wrong wall analogy. Because when I was competing, particularly when I was doing very well in that world, 2014, 2015, my ladder was up against the wrong wall to a degree, in the sense that I was happy when I got to the destination. Every time, if I did a show, I would get the photo shoots, I would get the medals, I would get the trophies, I would get the sponsorships, I would get all these things that came off the back. So I was happy with the destination, but I was fucking miserable during the process. Sure. So if we keep the analogy, it meant that when I was climbing the ladder, I hated climbing the ladder, but I was happy when I got to the destination. When I decided in 2018 to do Marathon de Sahara, which is 6 back-to-back marathons in the Sahara, which was a very difficult event, as you can probably imagine.
I loved following that. It was unreal.
Fantastic. It was tough. But with the ladder against the right wall, regularly, I checked in with my life to see, well, is this goal I've set for myself negatively impacting the things that are most important to me? So for too long, Adrian, I had what I call junk values, values that were external. Normally in the way that I looked, how much money I was making, all these things. I have now what I call like my true values, which is, you know, it's a list, it's people. It's my mom, my dad's in there now, particularly over the last few years, my daughter's in there, my partner's in there, and my best friends. Fulfilling work is in there, things I love to do. So they're my top values. So when I check in now with a goal I've set for myself, and I do endurance events, I have a big race in September, but none of those goals that I've set, Marathon de Saab, I ran through the Arctic in 2019, I have a 24-hour obstacle course race in September, none of those things are more important to me than my true values. So if they were impacting my life in a negative way, meaning that I was too tired to play with Holly, my daughter, or I was too, you know, caught up in training to spend time with my partner, or I was too obsessed with hitting a specific goal to meet my mom for coffee regularly, all of these things, if they were impacting it, I would cut them in a second. Sure. And I got better with that as the years went on. And I think if I knew now what I, if I knew then what I know now, I would have just got clear on what are the things that are the most important to me. And this is so relative for somebody else. It might be growing a business. It might be looking a certain way. And there's nothing wrong with those goals. We have different priorities based on the seasons of our lives, and they will change as you go along. And once you're clear on it though, and you're not operating kind of on autopilot, it's so much easier to focus on that journey and that destination. Because if you're happy on the journey and you're looking in and checking in going, well, actually, do I really like to eat this way? If you have a weight loss goal, it's going to be easier to hit your fat loss or weight loss goal. Do I like to train this way? If you have a body composition or a performance goal, it's going to be considerably easier to finish it and can keep doing it if you do enjoy it, and all of these things. And I think it applies for your job. It applies to relationships. Like, I love my partner to bits. She's the most incredible person in the world. And I love spending time with her. But if there was a case where spending every day with her made me want to tear my ears off, I'm like, well, this is feedback that I'm with the wrong person. And it's funny because that sounds so obvious, but yet sometimes we'll do it in our job where we fucking hate going into our job, or we hate spending time with somebody that, you know, is a friend because we were in school with them once, or you're limited by geography that, you know, we don't actually want to spend time with them anymore, but we feel obliged or obligated to do so.
Sure. Yeah.
Like they're all really good questions to ask. And I think that 97-year-old rule helps with that, where if you can fast forward to your 97-year-old deathbed and ask, well, what would you regret more, you know? And who is going to be there? Who'll cry when you die? That's another thing that I do regularly. That gives me feedback on who should I be spending time with? Like, I'm the king of no. Like, Gary, my assistant, is like, you say no to fucking everything. He just defaults to no now if he's answering. I say no to nearly everything, because when you know what you should be saying no to, it makes what you say yes to considerably easier. And there's an opportunity cost for every yes. And every time you spend time with somebody, it's time you're not spending with somebody else. And every time you spend doing one thing, it's time you're not doing something else. And as long as you're clear on, well, this is actually what I want to do. This is where I want my life to go. These are the people I want to be with. This is the thing that makes me fulfilled. This is the thing that makes me feel joy. This is the thing that I love to do. Like, don't confuse happiness and pleasure. They're two completely different fucking things, where people were like, you know, chasing pleasure or confusing it with happiness. Like, when I do these races and I do these challenges, they're not pleasurable. They fucking suck. But I feel really happy after them, because I'm like, well, I'm glad. I didn't know my body could go to that far. I didn't know it could push to that extreme. So I get this massive wave of fulfillment and confidence off the back of it, which, you know, translates to happiness for me. But again, it's relative to the person. Don't confuse pleasure and happiness. They're two very different things. And I think once you do that consistently, and if you fall back and you fuck up, that's cool too. Like, it's not a linear line of just going up. Like, I make more mistakes than anybody. You know, I had this conversation with my daughter. She's 7. Where she got in trouble in school. I won't get into what she got in trouble for. And she thought, like, she's at that age where she's, you know, afraid of her parents and all of that. And, you know, I told her, I was like, look, yeah, you made a stupid decision that was really silly, but what did you learn from it? And she was like, well, I shouldn't do that again. I'm like, yeah, brilliant. I was like, yeah, we all make mistakes. I'm like, that's cool. I was like, just don't make the same mistakes again. Don't make the same mistake twice. And I think that's something that we forget as adults, that mistakes are fine and failure is feedback. But once you don't make the same mistakes over and over again, you know, you're going to be successful in whatever it is you do, and you're going to be happy with whatever it is you're doing. And that I'll be happy when fallacy of I'll be happy when I hit X, Y, or Z tends to go away because you're a little bit more focused on, well, am I enjoying this process? Is this actually what I really want to do? You know, quitting because, you know, also something, sorry, I've gone off on a complete tangent now, Adrian, but like quitting is something else I think people, and myself, when I say people, I'm talking to my younger self, that it's worth considering, because people think quitting is a bad thing. I think quitting is a fucking brilliant thing to do, but you don't quit because something's hard. You quit because it's no longer what you want. Yes, there's a difference there. Big difference. And I think quitting because something hard is hard or too difficult is a very poor reason to stop doing something. You can, like, that's just discipline and mental resilience and building confidence to do it. But quitting because I don't want to do this anymore is different. Like, I quit my teaching job and it was the best thing I ever decided to do. I quit a relationship 10 years ago, 8 years ago, that I really didn't want to be in. And it was the best decision I ever made because I met my partner after that. And they're quitting because you don't, it's not what you want to do anymore. And if there's something that people are listening to now, or people listening to when there's something in their life that they want to switch directions, but they're afraid to quit for whatever reason, some cost fallacy, they put too much time, energy, money into something, you know, the story that's caught up in their head, it might be worth reevaluating. Because I think once you do that, the I'll be happy when fallacy can go away from it, because it's just consistently doing the right things, doing things that, you know, you enjoy, being around the people you enjoy doing. Like, don't overcomplicate life. Make a list of things that make you happy, do more of that. Make a list of things that make you unhappy and do less of that. Realistically, you can sum up the whole thing into that single sentence.
I actually heard you say that in your most recent podcast, Brian. Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's so many different areas that I kind of like to explore, but I'm also conscious of your time, Brian. But I also want to be mindful of our listeners here. And this is the Lifestyle Lifter Show. And Brian, a lot of our listeners, they do take pride in their appearance. They want to look good, feel confident in their clothes. They work 40, 50 hours a week, but they also want to, you know, maybe socialize the odd weekend or eat out at restaurants. So just for like the working professional that you're speaking to now, Brian, what would be like just some general like training and nutrition tips that you would offer someone who's in their mid-20s, early 30s, and they want to look a certain way, they want to feel a certain way, but they also want to feel confident in their clothes and be able to socialize too?
80% is enough. I think unless you have an extreme goal, competing, ultra marathons, photo shoots, whatever it is, extreme goals normally lead to extreme plans to get those extreme results. For someone working a 40, 50 hour week that wants the balance of, you know, I want to look good, but I want to feel confident when I go out, but I want to have a few beers, or I want to have my favorite food, I want to go to a restaurant, 80% is enough, meaning that you don't have to crush it all of the time. And if you get your nutrition dialed in 80% of the time, if you get your training right 80% of the time, you get your sleep right 80% of the time, you can have the best of all worlds. And now, of course, if your goals change and they become more extreme with what you want to do, obviously you need to probably increase that percentage. But for the majority of people, I think with the fitness industry, the way it is now, and I've tried to cut through this, but I think I definitely don't get there as much as I'd like with social media, more so on the podcast because it's long form. You don't need to have all your ducks in a row all the time to look a certain way and to hit a goal. You can go off plan and have the best of all worlds. And I would argue if you take a long enough time span, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, if you go off plan every weekend, that's a small portion, you know, not, and I don't think, don't press the fuck it button. That's different. Like, yes, don't go from, you know, eating chicken and salad Monday to Friday, training 50 hours a week. And then like Saturday, Sunday, it's like Bulmers for breakfast until Monday. Like, don't press the fuck it button either, but go out and have the foods and drinks you want to do, have the balance, have the lifestyle balance, and then reset and get back on plan on the Monday. You know, have that Monday to Friday flexible weekend. I think that works really well for people. I do it with people. I know you do too, Adrian, in your plans. People in my programs, I have that flexi approach with them for those what I call, you know, weekend warriors is a nice language, where Monday to Friday, it's really easy to stick to routine, but they want to have a balanced lifestyle where they're able to go out with their family or their friends or whatever it is at the weekend. I'm like, awesome. You know, go have your free meals, go have your few drinks. You know, if you can get your step counts in, brilliant. If you can get a workout in, brilliant. If you can't, no problem. And we reset again on Monday and we go again, but they're also not pressing the fuck it button. Like I said, absolutely, throwing everything out the window at the weekend. Yeah. I think that bringing awareness to that, bringing attention to that, and just bringing a little bit of education to that can be helpful for people.
Yeah, for sure. And we had a coaching call last night, and Brian, you alluded to it too yourself at the start, that you kind of had the all or nothing mindset maybe starting out, that you're either, you know, I'm sure with your food, it was either 100% on point, but you might press the fuck it button then if say you were to have a quote unquote bad food, and this can compound. And it's a difficult thing, because I've experienced myself, Brian. I tried to do Andy Frisella's 75 hard, yeah. Got to day 42 twice. And that's where, you know, you follow a diet, no cheat meals, no alcohol. And it worked. But then, you know, what happened when I forgot to take the progress picture? I automatically just went towards this food and used that as a coping mechanism, because it was just so, it was unsustainable. And sure, like, you can keep it going for a couple of days, or for some people, they might be super strict for 2 weeks. But then, you know, they feel that, like, you know, I've had a piece of chocolate, I've had a Supermax, I've had a McDonald's, I may as well keep going now. And yeah, that's a hard kind of mindset to get out of, Brian, where you don't, as you say, you don't just automatically turn the switch and flip the switch. And you understand that you're always just one meal, one workout, one action away from getting back on track.
100%. Like, the analogy I use in books is, it's like driving down the motorway, getting one flat tire and then getting out and slashing the other three tires because one went flat. That's the dietary equivalent of going off plan and then be like, all right, fuck it. May as well, you know, eat whatever I want now I've gone off plan. I'm like, no, you reset and you get back on plan again, or you make peace with the fact that you don't undo 7 days of progress or 6 days of progress with a meal. Like, you don't, you know what, people have that, you know, Christmas time. I know we're far away from it now, but that Christmas mindset of, oh my God, what's going to happen over Christmas Day and over up until New Year's. I'm like, look, you don't undo 51 weeks of progress in a week. Like, you just don't. And I think that mindset and that rational thought and logical thought, because we tend to take an emotional response when it comes to food, because it's a very emotional thing for a lot of us, myself included. And I think when you bring a bit of rational thought and a bit of logic to it, you're kind of like, actually, fuck it. It's actually not too bad. I'll be fine. I just reset and I go again.
Love it. I love it. I think that's it's a great mindset to work towards. And if anyone is out there, you know, it does take, as Alex Hormozi said, a bit of time under the bar and time under tension. You get better with age, Brian. But Brian, I just want to talk to a few more kind of brief topics before we wrap it up. Obviously, you mentioned in a recent podcast you're training for a 24-hour Spartan race, and this coming September, I believe, I think you were saying. But obviously, would you mind just kind of briefly talking us through the Marathon de Sable, your Achilles tendon and the Arctic Circle as well? Like, just in general, how do you even, like, as you said, how do you mentally even prepare for that? And then just the process of going through it.
Yeah, it's something that the Marathon de Sable is six back-to-back marathons through the Sahara Desert, and the Arctic Circle was 230 kilometers over 5 days through the Arctic. And I've covered both in podcasts, that for anyone that wants to go kind of deeper on them, but just to kind of give a brief synopsis on how I built up to do them, it's worth knowing that your starting point matters a great deal here. And by the time I'd set the goal of Marathon de Sable as a non-runner, as a self-proclaimed non-runner, I still don't enjoy running, as someone that grew up playing GA, playing football, and then went into obviously competing, bodybuilding, etc. I'm as far as from a runner as you can imagine. But I had a lot of my confidence built, Adrian, before that. Yeah. Competing in my first show in 2014 was so much more scarier to me than Marathon de Sable or running through the Arctic. And realistically and logically, it shouldn't be, because the Sahara is considerably more dangerous. I wasn't going to die on stage unless I tripped and fell over somebody and fell on my neck and broke my neck. Like, and the chance of that and the probability of that were so low, but the fear was so high. And I had similar, one of the best things, probably the worst things if you talk to some people, of having an online presence in social media is it forces you to look at yourself and work through a lot of fear. And most people, and you probably can attest to this as well, Adrian, when you're posting regularly your thoughts, your opinions, your ideas, that can be very scary for a lot of people, myself included when I started. And the fact that I had to do it because I thought what I was saying was able to help people, and I thought I had a duty to at least share my opinions on things in the hopes that it did that, got me over a lot of that fear. That, and fear can cross into different domains and different areas. So by the time I signed up to Marathon de Sable, which is a whole story in of itself, because I was terrified before I went to the Sahara, but that didn't really come until a week before. And I went and did that race. I got to the end, which I hobbled to the end. It was a, you know, using the term run wouldn't be an accurate description of my movement pattern, but I got to the end and I felt extremely confident off the back of that, partly because it was so out of my comfort zone, like so far outside of it. I'd never ran a marathon until I started to prepare for that race. And once I did it, I felt that limitation had been lifted, or that glass ceiling had been broken through. And I did the Arctic a year later, and I didn't have the fear around the Arctic. I knew I was going to complete it. I knew I was going to do it. And I tore my Achilles 86 kilometers from the end of the Arctic.
Wow.
And yeah, it was so painful and so sore. But unless my legs fell off, I was going to finish.
Yeah.
And confidence is one of those things that you get more confidence when you set whatever goal you set for yourself and you hit it. Yeah. And because I had done the Sahara, you're able to use it, what I call either a fear anchor or a confidence anchor. You can use a time in the past when you were afraid to help you deal with something that you're afraid of in the current. So anytime I got any fear around the Arctic, I thought about, well, you ran through the Sahara. You did that. You'll be fine in the Arctic. And it can sound left field to people, but I use the analogy of, like, think of the first time you ever kissed a guy or a girl. Like, I remember my first kiss, Adrian, I was like 11 years old. She was 12. And it was like on holidays in Kerry. And I was like in her hotel room. I don't know what the fuck I was doing in her hotel room, but that's where we were. And I remember just sitting on opposite ends of the bed thinking, fuck, is there a way that we can kiss here and me tell everyone we did and maybe not kiss? Because I was so nervous. And then when we did it, I was like, well, what was the big deal? And that's kind of how fear is.
Sure.
It's kind of like, it's so scary before it's done. And then when you do it, a lot of the cases you look back and go, what was I so afraid of? And that ranges all the way from the first kiss to doing any extreme challenge you set for yourself. And I think when you can anchor that fear or anchor that confidence in the past of something where you push through, I think anyone that has studied exams or has test anxiety or asked anyone out on a date ever has done something in the past that they were afraid to do would end up working out, or you got feedback on, well, actually, I would approach that slightly different next time. But the world didn't end. You know, when you fear set and realize that actually the worst case scenario, it was nowhere near that, it helps you deal with the fear in the future. So Marathon de Saab, running through the Arctic, you know, training for the Spartan race, which is in September, all of these things, they build on one another. And the weird thing about endurance and the weird thing about fitness is it becomes your new normal, where you end up walking around and everything is relative. And I'm aware this is the downside of me doing these challenges because they're my normal now. So unless I'm talking to somebody else who's in the space, it sounds so extreme and so ridiculous to anyone who's not in the space. And it would have, if you would ask me, you know, 2015, 2016, before I had heard of any of these challenges, but everything becomes your new normal.
Yeah.
And just make sure that your new normal, your diet, your fitness, your training, your goals, your relationship, your job is something that you want to be your normal. And because it's going to set that way, whether you like it or not. And I'm aware it can remove me from being relative with people or being relevant to people because it can feel so extreme, but pull it back into your own life. What's your version of that? What's your extreme goal? Weight loss, fat loss, building muscle, asking somebody out, switching jobs. What's your thing that you're afraid of now, that challenge that you want to do? And then, you know, use those confidence anchors, use those fear anchors. And, you know, it's such a trite cliche, but on the other side of fear is the person you want to be. It's a useful kind of way to see it, because in most cases, it tends to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you used the acronym before, false evidence appearing real, Brian. Something that really resonated with me. That's awesome, man. And I think that ties back into what you said previously, that you never let yourself get too high or too low. I was reading a book, How to Be an Astronaut, I think it was, or something along those lines. But basically, the guy, he was in space, obviously, two or three times. And he said, Chris Hadfield. And he just kind of said, never let yourself get too high or too low, because what a lot of astronauts felt challenged with was when they were able to see, you know, the Earth from space, that was like the new norm. But then just the everyday, the coffees, the chats, just the everyday lifestyle, it didn't reach those expectations. So they kind of felt a bit disappointed and a bit deprived, because it's kind of like they had to get to that new level to kind of feel some element of fulfillment. Great point, Brian. Just Brian, quick fire Q&A, a couple of last questions. What's one new habit that you've implemented since last year?
I drink kombucha every day instead of, I was trying to kick Diet 7 up, which is still a vice of mine. A weird vice, I know, but it's a vice I've tried to kick. But now I drink kombucha every day as kind of a way to offset that.
Interesting. Okay. Number two, when you hear the word successful, Brian, who's the first person that comes to mind?
My future self.
Awesome. Awesome. Favorite movie?
The Shawshank Redemption or The Godfather. I watch both of those every year. I love both.
Class. Yeah, deadly, deadly. And last one, Brian, what's one question you wish the people asked you more?
Oh, that's a good one. Why am I doing things? I think sometimes, and I can't quick fire this one, but something I've tried to open up the dialogue on my podcast is how context matters so much. And the most recent podcast I did, the things I changed my mind about since 2016, when I started the podcast, kind of explores this, that people do things for a certain reason, myself included. And there's so much context that most of us won't have or don't have that we can make judgment either on ourselves or on other people without all of that context. And I think it's important. And I have to remind myself, because I'm like everybody, I can default to judgment. I'll see something that angers me or annoys me, and I sometimes forget that it's a projection or a mirror to me that is something I should probably be dealing with internally. And I don't know what's going on in that person's life. I don't know why they posted that or why they said that. You know, maybe they love riling people up. Maybe they feel really insecure and they need a little bit of external validation right now. Maybe something's really bad in their life and this is their outlet and their way of working through it. There's so much I don't know. There's a story in, I want to say Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, but it might be from a different book, on a girl walking through the subway and kids going absolutely fucking crazy. And their dad is just sitting there ignoring the kids. And about 10 minutes go by on the subway and the kids are bouncing off the walls, a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And the woman turns to the man and goes, "Can you please control your kids?" And he looks up and goes, "I'm so sorry. I didn't even notice. I'm just back from the hospital. My wife died of cancer." And that fucking landed with me like a ton of bricks. That we can go through life so often making judgments of other people, not realizing what they're dealing or what they're carrying. And I try and remind myself of it so often. And I think a question to ask before we rush to those judgments, myself included, is why is that person doing what they're doing? And I think it's a good wrap up to everything we've talked about here, something I try and remind myself of regularly. And I think when you know that people are doing something and they have a reason for doing it, it can make us just a bit less judgmental and it can give us a little bit more context. And it also helps to pull it back on you. Why are you doing something? Because when you know why you're doing it, it can give you that fuel to either continue with it or to potentially change direction if it's not the thing you want to do.
Brilliant. Awesome. Brian, just want to say thank you so much. I want to acknowledge you, honestly, for selfishly, first of all, like, you've really paved the way for me and you've been a real role model of as to what's actually possible when you put your mind to something. And the fact that, again, you kind of helped break my self-limiting belief that, you know what, it is possible to pursue your passion, to help other people, and to actually become a fitness coach, because you showed the way. And then I said, you know, I'm no different to anyone else to Brian Cade. So I just want to thank you so much for that. And just also then, I love your message, man. Just health, longevity, lifestyle, fitting it all in. Getting the right balance between the fitness, the business, and you're just someone who I really look up to and aspire to. So just thank you so much for that. And finally, Brian, just last two questions that I always ask my guests. I'm big into morning routine. So Brian, what do the first 30 to 60 minutes of your day look like?
They're driving, listening to a podcast because my gym is 40 minutes away.
Gotcha.
So that 36 minutes is 6 minutes of me trying to put on clothes, trying to gather up my things for the morning because I'm a zombie when I wake up, and 30 minutes of listening to a podcast. And then I train faster nearly every morning, not every morning, but 5 days a week.
Awesome. Awesome. I like training faster too. And last question, Brian, because it's the Lifestyle Lifters show, you've You've indirectly answered this multiple times already, but what is your definition, Brian, of someone who lives a successful lifestyle?
I think success is something that is so subjective. And my version of it is making sure that I can, and I'm excited to jump out of bed every morning. I think once that happens, as someone that has had my own mental health issues, has had my own stupid decisions that have led me to not wanting to get out of bed because there was people in my life I didn't want to be with. There was jobs I was doing I didn't want to do. And I'm like, oh my God, I just want to pull the covers over me. Using now that question of am I excited to jump out of bed every morning is what it means to me. And I think success is so relative that you need to know what it means to you. But I think that's a pretty good metric for me anyway. As long as I'm feeling like that every single morning, I know I'm on the right path. And, you know, the days lead into weeks, the weeks into months, the months into years. And that inevitably gets you to that 97-year-old deathbed if we're fortunate enough to get that far. So I think checking in with that question regularly is something that helps.
Wow, unbelievable. Brian Kane, thank you so much. Been an absolute pleasure. And for all our listeners out there, if you did get value from this, please do share on your IG stories. And Brian, finally, where can people, if the one or two listeners who do not know anything about you, Brian, where can people learn more about you and what you offer?
No, thanks so much, Adrian. I love this conversation. And mate, keep doing what you're doing. I fucking really appreciate the time and the opportunity to speak on your platform. I know you're doing great things with the podcast and Instagram and social media in general. So a massive thank you. For anyone that wants to check out me, the Brian Keane podcast, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, I'm on everything as the Brian Keane Fitness. And then the podcast is the Brian Keane podcast. So yeah, anywhere where people want to check out, just put me into Google and I'm literally on everything.
Unbelievable. Brian Keane, thanks so much. Absolute pleasure, my man.
Pleasure was all mine. Thanks, Adrian.